Hello, welcome to Meet the Author podcast, brought to you by Graphic Publishing. I'm Kieran Maness-Jones. Today, it's all about the Rita series of children's books. I'm the author, Myra Zapf, and the illustrator, Andrew Whitson, a.k.a. Mr. Andrew, on the podcast to talk about their collaboration on the Rita series. How are you guys?
We're very well, thanks. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming on. It's an absolute pleasure. First off, just about you, Andrew, you're the illustrator for this series of books, and Myra, you're the author. How did you come about collaborating together? Where did that come from?
So I suppose I have always admired Andy's work from afar. Andrew, you should probably close your ears at this point so that I don't give you a really, really big head. But I was poring over the illustrations in his books for many years before we worked together. And I remember the day that Katrina, from Antna Hadjwar, from the publisher, she came over to me at a book launch and she said, you know, what do you think about working together? And it was like a seed was planted, you know, and it's a wonderful thing now looking back. And we've made 7 books together, Andy, in this series. But it's lovely to see sometimes, you know, the human moments that lead to the collaborations. But you had then come to me and said that you were looking for a character, a character that would live beyond the page. Isn't that right? It was, the idea was of a series. It was the strategic intent behind the thing, a character who would be sort of larger than life and that kids would recognize and grow to love. And so I sent you a story that I already had, which was Rita Wants a Robot. And then I suppose it was, we took it from there to try and see if she could become a series, if that was the character that was going to lead us that way. But you tell me from your side, Andy.
Well, I think it was a very organic process. We did. We knew of Myra, and we knew Myra was a very talented writer. And when we all met at the exhibition, we just kind of got chatting about what we would like to achieve in the next couple of years. And we had this idea that we'd like to do a series of books for a specific age group. And when Myra then said that she had an idea for a story, then of course we got together, and it was a very organic process and very natural and very unforced. The only thing that I had no clue about at that stage was the actual visual iconography of the Rita character and how that was going to be developed. So Myra was kind of way ahead of me on that one because she already had this really strong concept for this story, but I had no visual for it. So I needed to get offside for a while and start sketchbooking the Rita character, because if it was going to be a series of stories, it needed to be something that was going to be consistent through each book. And that was the hardest part for me, because up until that point, I had only done one-off books with the character only existing within one story. And for this idea that I knew we were going to do at least 4 books. So the character had to be a consistent character, which needed to be very strongly developed from the very beginning.
It's quite exciting now, looking back at that process, Andrew, as well. You know, you feel like there's some sort of inevitability about something once it's been done. But when you look back at those times and those initial sketches and those initial conversations, it was not inevitable, I suppose, that we ended up where we did. But the thing that I find was really interesting as well about that process was finding, like, turning one book into a series and seeing how much do you decide a format of a thing, a formula, and how much do you steer away from that? And it was a kind of a balancing act as well, wasn't it? From the visual look to the themes to the sort of story shape that would be consistent enough across the series, but that would leave us the freedom. And we wanted that quite strongly, didn't we? The freedom to be able to follow different ways of doing things in different books as well. And I think that's kind of where we've ended up, that the books are not all the same. It's not just another one of the same. They all have their own different personality.
I remember us sitting down, Myra, and having a chat about this, and we both said we need to avoid any predictability about these stories. So although we agreed on a format and a certain style of story, we always wanted to shy away from the idea that when you to the next Rita story, that there it would be predictable and you didn't really need to go into it in any depth. So I do think we've succeeded in that idea, that each Rita story has its own merit. Every Rita book has its own little quirky style, which isn't quite the same as the previous book, which I thought was a very strong aspect of this, because so many books you do see in the series have exactly the same visual iconography, exactly the same style, which is rigid and stays the same. But with Rita, I get the feeling we're always discovering a new part of Rita through our art. So our art isn't static. It's not like we're saying, this is how far we've got in our art base, our art skill, and this is as far as we're going to take it. We're always exploring and pushing the boundaries to try and bring it to another level. And I think that is with both of us.
Definitely.
It's obviously been very successful because, like you said, you envisioned four books and you've done more than four. And I can see what you mean by that consistent story, but there's definitely room to explore Rita's kind of personality and what Rita wants. And in terms of the illustration itself, it definitely evolves over the course of the books as well. Her character and her red hair and her black and white top, is that something that you discuss between you, or is that mostly your job as the illustrator, Andrew?
Myself and Maura are very respectful of each other's talents and skills. But in saying that, we're very collaborative in the whole process. So when I first began Rita, it was very much using pen and paper and paint, and explored the character through those range of media. And what would then happen would be I would take a photograph and email it to Maura and say, what do you think of this? And Maura is the best critic because she says that everything is fantastic. And you never feel and you never feel, oh, I've done a really crap job here. So in one hand, that was really, really positive and helped me to move forward. But it took me, I actually do remember the night I was sitting down at the studio, and it was very, very late in the day, but I was pushing forward with Rita. I got pen and ink drawing it together, and I started to use paper as the color background. And I just went, that's the character. That's Rita right there. And it was the design of the hair with the three pointy hairstyles on each side of the ears, and the way the bubble was at the top of her head, and the shape of the actual hair on top of the head. I just knew I got it there. But as I progressed, I've been moving from organic media to digital media. And I think that's where you see the progression in the character.
Just to butt in on that, Andrew, I think my experience in working with other illustrators before you and I worked together was always that the author and the illustrator were kept very in very separate spaces, if you like. And so it was all very controlled. So, you know, you would send your text to the publisher, they would pick an illustrator, you would give them notes or whatever. But then the next thing you see is the finished piece, at which point, you know, there's a little tiny bit of back and forth, but there was none of that kind of sense of openness. And I think that that's something that very often exists within publishing for very protective reasons of the art, if you know what I mean, because the last thing you want is an author telling you what the pictures should, you know, that's a nightmare scenario. So my experience of working with you is not that we're collaborating on the illustrations in any way, but it's just that you allow me an open door into what you're doing, and it's a very precious thing because I get to see the thing as it evolves. And it's not for me to say that's wrong or that's right, but it's like sounding board, or, you know, it's just kind of, and it's really lovely. And I think that it works because there's trust between us, that the other person isn't going to go, no, that's rubbish, start again, or to try and over control what each other are doing, because I think that would be the kiss of death to creative collaboration in that way. But I have to say, I feel very, very privileged that you let me see these sketches and scribbles along the way. And it's just amazing to see it as it kind of gradually takes shape. It's really beautiful.
But the thing is, Maura, I mean, I can't really sit in my own little turret at the top of my castle just creating this stuff visually and then not sharing it until the last moment when the book's to be published, because I feel then it doesn't open the thing up. I mean, that's my working practice generally, is to work through the designs and then share them on email.
I think the other place where we do that, where we sort of throw the ball to each other, is in that deciding which character, because we decided from the start that Rita would imagine or fantasize, bring into being a different character in each book. And so sometimes there's been really funny email exchanges going like, Andy, do you fancy a ninja? What do you think of an alien? How would you feel about it? You know, and And so that can be quite funny because I'll have like a scrap of an idea or a fragment of something, but I kind of want to test the waters with you first. Go, maybe this is like, maybe you hit genies. Maybe, you know, maybe Arabian Nights is like, you know, a trigger for some childhood trauma for you. I don't know. So we sort of throw it back and forth a little bit to get an idea that we know we'd both like to work in.
In the stories themselves where Rita kind of wants something to do a certain task, do you decide the character first or do you decide what task she wants to achieve and then work out a character that would fit that?
It sort of depends. And each book has come to being a little bit differently. Very often those characters that she wishes for or that she wants very badly, they are sort of an embodiment of something, a representation of something. But it sort of depends. So, for example, the dragon is anger, you know, is a representation of the overwhelming feeling of anger. And the story really is about her growing into the ability to tame that anger. So that came about because I wanted to write about that theme. You know, the theme came first about children and learning healthy ways of acknowledging what they're feeling and relation to things I've been reading about children and mental health and various things. And so that came as the kind of, this is the theme. What character could you use to embody that? So that was where the dragon came from, for example. But sometimes it's a, like, say, for example, the genie. The genie is a granter of wishes, and it could have been another granter of wishes. And that one I just really fancied playing in that world, like sitting in that sandbox for a while. But really that story is a different one. It's about the siblings' relationship and about, you know, sharing and who's in control of the play and those types of issues that could have been played out in lots of different worlds with a wish giver, if you see what I mean. So it sort of depends on the story.
And these characters kind of embody essentially a theme of the book, I guess, Rita's trying to tackle. So in terms of Rita herself trying to get through, you know, everyday life, wishing she had a robot, wishing she had a genie, is the overall theme something that you're trying to educate children about, or are these, I suppose, not purposely educate, but, you know, let them know? And are these experiences from your own life with children, or are they just like general problems children have?
All of the above, I would say, Kieran. I never sit down to write a book with the intention to educate a child. Like that's not what I feel like I'm there to do. But if I can start a conversation, if I can tickle some questions or some thoughts in their mind that they might look at something and go, oh, I hadn't thought of that. That I would love to do, because those are the kind of books that I enjoy reading myself. But really what's going on in these books for Rita, it's just kind of her thought world. And I suppose it's as connected to my thought world as it's connected to a child's thought world. When we look at the possibilities of something and we brainstorm the possibilities, and then we go, oh, what about all the repercussions? And then we go into a sort of a negative cycle about, oh, but that could go wrong and that could go wrong. It's just that, you know, that's quite a normal way of weighing up decisions and thoughts for everyone. But in Rita's world, you get then this kind of dollop of ridiculousness and playfulness and silliness, where she can, rather than in the everyday ways that we have these thought processes, when she does it, it'll have like ridiculous or crazy consequences, which is great fun to write. And obviously a lot more entertaining for the child who's reading it. But it's I guess it's about those mental processes, maybe, as much as anything else. Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of the illustration side then, Andrew, when you're creating this world, which is clearly in Rita's imagination, does that allow you more freedom with your illustration to go wacky and wild places?
Oh, 100%, Kieran. I was just thinking there as Mario was talking about Rita and the dragon. It was never initially conceived that the dragon story would be in the snow. And then it occurred to me that if the dragon's going to breathe fire and water has three states, then if snow was one of those, then you'd have the water as water and then the water as steam. And the dragon could be setting off those elements in their different states as part of the storytelling session. So I really get off on that. I really get like the idea of bringing something to the story that Moira has already set in place.
You actually solved a problem that I had written into the story as well, Andy, because I seem to remember that my original manuscript for the dragon story had an awful lot of destruction in it. Because the dragon was torching like towns and villages and forests. And so you very cleverly, by using the snow, ended up with this kind of much gentler way of showing the effects of the anger.
Yeah, that's right. I remember now, because it was all about if Rita was to destroy her environment all around her, that's not necessarily the message we want to convey in the story. So by directing it at the snow, then that produced the same kind of effect, but as you say, more on a more gentler level. And I mean, if you look at the illustrations for that one, the mum and the little brother are buried in the snow towards the end. You see the tip of the umbrella disappear into the snow. And it's not that sinister. It's just a little bit of taking it to the limit you want to go with Rita. And I suppose with also the genie story, when Mara presented me with the genie and I work on the design of the character, I just loved the idea that the character's arms wouldn't be part of the body. And I was thinking, yes, it'd be fantastic for an animation. The animators would love this. And also the idea that Rita goes into the lamp at the end of the story with the genie. And you can actually visually suggest a lot of things, but the reader has to look for them. They're not obvious. So if you look at the inside of the lamp, when Rita goes into it, the genie's got his side of the lamp, which is really well furnished with lovely carpets and lovely bed and lots of reading material. And he's not quite happy about Rita being in the same space. So Rita's space is basically a bucket and a little toilet roll, as if she's in prison. And the genie's just saying, right, my job has been done. That's where you are now in the lamp. So little visual cues that I can bring in and to help build on the story that Moira's already produced. And I really enjoy the freedom of that.
One of my favourite things about children's books especially is that the story comes through not in just the words that you're reading, but also the illustration, which makes children's books one of the most visually captivating. And obviously to younger children, that obviously helps a lot in their enjoyment of reading the book. Do you find it very helpful to collaborate, but both of you together, where you're finding that Andrew's maybe drawing something that isn't specifically said in your words? Does that help to create a much wider world and a more encaptivating world than just the words themselves?
I think, if you don't mind me, I'll answer this first, Andy, but an awful lot of authors find that they start off when they begin to write picture books by writing too much, like not leaving enough space for the illustrations to tell the story. And I guess I was kind of on a learning curve in that. And by the time I started working on Rita with Andy, I think I was pushing myself quite far the other way. So how little can I say?
Yeah.
And how much can we do in the illustrations? So it's quite funny when you look at a book like that and how little text there is on any given page. And actually very often, Andrew, when I send it to you, very often it'll have like, you know, what would happen next? And then obviously there'll be a kind of, well, this might happen next and this might happen next. And then that's the bit where I sort of bounce it to you with some initial kind of ideas. And sometimes they are the ones that end up and sometimes they're not. And that's definitely where the magic happens, because that you have the framework for the story, but that there are those spaces left for the story. And actually sometimes there's a completely different story being told in the pictures. Like in the Ninja book, there is really a storyline that's going on there in that relationship between Rita and her little brother that isn't necessarily explicit in the text at all. And I think it's key to picture books.
Yeah. I've really just enjoyed the freedom of that, Mara. I mean, because we work so well together on these stories, you know, it's actually, I'm being spoiled really, to be honest, because when we did the first book, Rita Wants a Robot, there was no real mention of the little brother. But in the illustrations, by putting the little brother in, pointing to what has happened with the robot destroying the Christmas tree and the shock, the illustrations fed me to think, you know what, it'd be lovely if we brought the little brother in for the next story as well. And it just doesn't have to be explicit. It can just be somewhere in the background. that you just bring this little character in. And as by the time we got to the genie story, that became almost a central part of the story itself and the relationship between the two of them and how to share. But it, as Mara says, it's not always written in the text. It's just somewhere in the background. And I think it spreads out the feeling of the depth of the story.
Yeah.
I think the Rita stories at the first visit can seem basic, but they're really not basic at all. There's a lot in them in terms of the marrying of the text with the illustrations.
Quite essential to the way that it gets read as well, because basically that experience, when you've written a picture book or when you've illustrated a picture book, it's not going to be read like any other book. You've got already a collaboration of people involved, because you're going to have a reader of it as well as your actual reader who's listening to it. But that's fundamental to that experience, that the leaving the space for the illustrations, in the case of these books, also leaves the space for the conversation. Because when you read that line of text at the start, what automatically happens, if you need to read the pictures, which you do in those books, is that the adult and the child start having a conversation about, oh, what's happening here? How did that happen? And that's part of that teasing out of the themes of whatever it is that you want to talk about, whether it's which clothing she's wearing and why it's wrong or why it's funny or what's happening with the little brother or whatever's going on in those pictures. And Andy's fabulous at putting lots of detail in, that when the story is read for the 20th time and for the 50th time, that there's still lots there for the child to be finding and for the adults to be finding that will enable that conversation. Because to me, that's the biggest connection that happens with reading picture books at an early age. Yes, there's the words and the stories and the pictures, but actually what you're really, really trying to create is that connection between the person who's reading it and, you know, and the child, because that's the thing that you take with you then afterwards, those conversations that you're having with a little one where you can refer back to a conversation you were having over books. So yeah, that space is important on so many levels.
Yeah. And your first book, Rita Wants a Robot, I actually got right here. And I think that page is like a great example of what you're saying about, I mean, the text doesn't say that's happening, but the robot's in the background mowing up the flowers and organising them, mm-hmm. which is just that it expands so much. And like you said, it creates that conversation about what's he doing.
It's quite a philosophical question, that, about tidying up things that are supposed to be wild. and that's a lot of what was in that book, was like, OK, we tell children that tidying up is important and order is important. And actually, when you unpick it for any of us, it's such a complex thing about when we want order and when we don't want order, and when it's anti-creative or anti-nature, or the impacts that order can have on us. And it's actually just deeply, deeply complex. And it's fun because you can use a character like a robot as an anti-human, you know, in order to work out, actually, these are the things that make us human, the fact that we don't want everything ordered. And so it's like, I think there's deep conversation there for people of any age.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you can also read it at a very simple level, and it's, you know, funny pictures and a nice little story. But actually, there's kind of no end to where you can go with it, in a sense.
Especially in the climate of at the moment, where in Britain, the government's trying to promote rewilding of areas. You know, so it's very current in its approach as well. And the whole idea that you shouldn't try to order nature and try and bring back a lot of the countryside that's been destroyed through agriculture. And also, I mean, from my perspective, I just like the idea of putting things in. That there's one thing in that book that no one's ever got back to me about, which is a little plane at the end, and that's Amelia Earhart's plane.
Is it?
So the number on that is the number on her plane. And no one has picked up on that.
I mean, I certainly didn't pick
up on
that.
Well, they will now. You heard it here first. to be honest, the inspiration for that story for me came from, I'd been really enjoying this artist called Urso Sverli, who I think is Swiss, but I'm not sure. And he has these really mad books, which are like photographic art books, where he basically deconstructs something. So you look at a car park, and then he'll take another picture of the car park with all of the cars in order of color and size and everything sort of taken apart and put in order. Or he'll do the same with a bag of crisps or with like a bowl of alphabet soup or something. And so you'll have a photo of the object, and then you'll have a photo of it all taken apart and ordered. And it's such an insane thing when you look at it. It actually makes you feel really uncomfortable in certain ways. Like it's really comforting to see order, and it's really, I don't know, it has some other effect on me that I can't describe. Yeah, but both simultaneously. And I just thought, there's something in this. And my kids at the time were a bit obsessed as well, because I kept showing them these pictures, and they kept doing this almost like play, where they would take something and then they'd sort it all out in these different ways. And I just thought it was amazing. It was like, and there's no right answer to how you sort it. You know, you sort it so many different ways, and different people will find different ways of looking at that. But that's actually where the story came from. I was thinking, oh, here, we could make a character who does this.
The scary thing about that, Mara, is I can so relate to that, because the amount of times I've caught myself on with a box of Smarties, I don't like the Smarties in the box. I like to empty them out and then start to sort them.
I do that as well.
On the table.
I do that all the time with Smarties and Skittles and anything with colour.
Yeah.
I only eat one colour at a time.
I actually line mine up like a little grid on the table.
Or the things I never knew about you till today, Andrew.
There you go.
But it's actually quite interesting, because that's one of the things that I would do with that book in school, is and with really young kids, but and you tell the teachers it's maths, but really it's not. It's just sorting, and that you can take these different colours and shapes and patterns of blocks, and then I sort of have a big wheel and they spin it, and then they have to sort it according to whatever that system is. But what they do is they see then that actually there's not one way of sort. You know, you can sort it by pattern, you can sort it by size, you can sort it by color, and that you'll end up with completely different answers. Or you can do it just with a box of Lego, you know, get the kids to sort it according to different categorizations, I suppose. And it's a really, really fun activity for them to do. But it's kind of an infinity. Once you start sorting, you see you get a bit obsessed, I think.
Yeah.
And who needs a sorted Lego box, you know? Life's too short for a sorted Lego box, I think.
That's not natural.
No.
So with regards to the individual characters that, you know, Rita wants a witch, Rita wants a robot, Rita wants a dragon, how do you decide what good traits and bad traits each character has?
So I suppose to some extent it's her freedom and her lack of freedom, or the possibilities and then the possible disasters. And so I sort of touched on that before, that it's probably something to do with my own decision making, that that's the way that those books kind of evolved. But I guess the good things are just about trying to put yourself into a child's shoes, and just, it's like pure fantasy, like to have all the power, all the ability, all the skill, the things that kids don't have.
Yeah.
To have the control, to have, you know, all the choice. These are things that they don't have. And so it's the fantasy of all of those possibilities. And then when it comes to the downsides, they're the bits that actually are the most fun to write. I don't know if it's the same for the illustrations, Andy, but that's where I have always had so much fun going, where could I make this go wrong? I once had the realization that being a writer is actually such a cruel profession. Like, you spend so much of your time taking characters and putting them in their nightmare scenarios. Like, what would be the worst possible thing I could do with this person right now? So that's great fun. It really, really is great fun, because they have to be. And you have, bear in mind that it's going to be illustrated. So it's not just what's the worst thing in your head or your heart, but what's going to look like the funniest thing. You know, what situation is just. And this is the thing I love about reading these books to large groups of children, is kids will gasp and they'll shout and they'll go, no. And they'll really react very, very loudly to these situations where things start to go wrong, which I just think is great fun. And then the answer is always, yeah, maybe we won't bother with this. Maybe we'll just figure it out in the real world. An imperfect real solution.
So in terms of then illustrating the good and the bad, Andrew, does your experience differ tomorrow, or is that relatively what you go through as well?
Oh, I just love it. I just think, how far can I take this? I mean, with Rita wants a genie. The opening scene is Rita with her little brother playing in the garden. Now, I mean, who has a shark in their tank? in the garden. So I just
That was not my fault. That was definitely you, Andy, wasn't it? Because I just said Rita likes to be in charge or something. And then it was like, when I saw the pictures, I couldn't believe it. She's trying to make the little brother walk the plank into a shark-infested paddling pool.
So, yeah, I have to say, as artistic license, I just really, I mean, if I'm going to feed my soul, I'm going to do it that way. I'm going to just decide to do something that really just makes me laugh. And just the idea of that, I just thought, yeah, this is exactly the kind of illustration I want to do. I mean, with the ninja book, Rita Wants a Ninja, I just love the idea that ninja do get the little brother and hang him from a rope and put a tape over his mouth. You know,
we're not afraid to go there, really, are we?
No, and the poor child has never said a word in any of the books. So, yeah, it's really about knowing how far you can take it within reason. You're not going to offend someone and you're not going to cause distress to the child, you know, but also that they can understand the fun side. I mean, when we were kids, you did things when you were younger, playing in the street or playing in the trees or playing in the woods that were a bit, you know, risky enough, like building ramps for your bike and jumping off a, you know, a tree or whatever you're doing. It was always a kind of, you know, always kind of risky. I mean, I remember as a kid building a swing at the end of the street on a tree and then building a dam and coming back one day and the whole street was flooded. You know, because the dam was so good. You know, my father didn't think that now, but the kids had a great time in that street for about half a day. So I love that freedom of childhood coming through in the illustration.
And that we can be so overprotective of that in some senses. But I think what we can do in picture books and an illustration like that is when it's so clear to the child that you're in a world that's not real, that you can play with those things, you can play with danger, you can play in a way that you can't when it's very real. Because, 100%. It's, you know, and so I remember wondering when we were doing the witch book, because the witch book is really, from a thematic point of view, it's actually really about mothers or carers. It's, and the witch is actually an auntie character in that one. She's the auntie mum. And that's kind of her role, is to be not all the things that your mummy's not, both in the positive and the negative. If your mum's good at putting you to bed on time, you know, the witch will let you fly around all night in a broomstick. But equally, if your mum knows what to do when you're sick, the witch really won't. And so it's kind of that's what we were playing with. But we ended up reaching into, because it was a witch, reaching into some of those kind of fairy tale worlds that everybody knows. That's a really common currency. And so there was one scene where it goes, where will it all end? And really, actually, Rita's in the cage, like going to be eaten and cooked by the witch, right? And it's pure Hansel and Gretel. That's where it's inspired from. But I remember thinking, oh God, have we gone too far? You know, thinking, well, and then realizing, no, we haven't, because, and the style of the illustration and the knowledge that this is something out of a book, this is not a real thing. Oh, there you have it. Yeah, that's it.
Very good.
You have it, and you have the stove there ready to cook the child. But I think that's the thing, is when you're being utterly clear that you're dealing in fictional and in fantastical, then you have the scope to explore some of that stuff in an unafraid way that maybe allows people to deal with things that they can't deal with head on. Your actual fear is one that will be really difficult to face, but your kind of fairy tale fear is one that you can play with.
Well, I'm gonna let you into a little secret here. I was really frightened of witches as a child, and it was probably because I wasn't able to separate the fiction from reality, and it was due to the fairy tales. It was due to the Hansel and Gretel story, and the idea that the witch was feeling the finger of the child to see if the child was fattened up for eating. And actually, as a very, very young child, that story didn't really have the same effect. But once I got to around the age of 6 or 7, when I started to understand the concept better, then it actually did get really under my skin a bit. And just going back on that now, that stayed with me for quite a while. And I don't think the Rita books are at that level at all. I think they make reference to these stories, but the humor, I think, within them supersedes that.
there's been a huge change as well in how those stories are told to children since we were children. And sometimes, like I sometimes do sessions with kids on this and how fairy tales and myths have changed over time. And they're quite shocked by the story versions that we had as normal. And I think we were quite shocked at the ones that the generation before us had. And it's not just in terms of the darkness of them, but it's also in terms of all sorts of guilt and nasty sort of ideas about children's places and stuff, well, that are nasty to us now, that were normal then, that are all wound into those things as well. And it's quite interesting because I sometimes wonder if we haven't gone very far the other way, where, you know, so many of those story fairy tales and whatever might have lost some of their power by being, you know, over saccharinized, you know, but where nobody dies at the end and nobody's really in danger and everything's really okay.
Yeah.
Because I think actually the stories are where we explore some of this stuff that we can't do in the real world in the same way.
Yeah, I mean, I think these different themes throughout the books really kind of gives you more of a sense. And as you mentioned, you wanted Rita to develop as a series character, not like a standalone character. So I feel like you learn a lot more about Rita as you go through these different books. Do you have lots of ideas for books that don't get made? Or do you go to write one and think, let's do that, and then go to write another and think, let's do that? Or do you have like all of these things that could possibly be part of Rita's future?
Yeah, so I have many notebooks, which are Rita notebooks, and they have many, many, many stories in them that won't ever become a story. They also have many pages on them that are just character brainstorms. And sometimes I learn more from the ones that don't work, where you go, why can't I write that story? Okay, she wouldn't do that, or that wouldn't be her, or... And it's quite an interesting process. I always think that the stories that don't make it aren't wasted. They're all part of the process of writing the ones that do. But we're in an interesting place with this series coming out in Welsh and in English with Graphic at the moment, because they all started life in Irish with Into the Hedge War first and have been translated. So we're kind of on a different timescale. We're further ahead. So we're on book 7 that we've just finished, and we actually have another 5, I guess, kind of already there, ready to go. So we've gone very far into all of the places that Rita may go in the future, and those are written already. But that's been a really interesting journey, and as I say, it's not a straight line. It's definitely a kind of, okay, that one isn't right for Rita. And why, and trying to learn each time more about what is and isn't right for her.
Yeah, so you're quite far ahead then in terms of books that you've kind of sorted. And then you just touched upon it, but Rita is now available in 3 different languages, Welsh, English and Irish. How did you feel when you found out Rita was going to be available in these languages as well as Irish?
It was actually fantastic for us. I mean, working with Peter from Graphegg on this was really a dream come true for us, I think. Myself and Maura were very excited by the whole process of this. The idea that Rita would go into, I suppose Welsh was the first port of call for us because of the Celtic languages. And what we would have liked to have had would have been a Scottish publisher at the same time to have celebrated the idea of 3 Celtic languages simultaneously bringing out the Rita content. But I think Peter was very much a great advocate for the books, and was very supportive and brought that forward. And as we now see the books reinvented in a slightly different format through Graphegg, we are very excited by the whole thing. It just seems to be the right way to go. It's very organic, very, very ordinary, very simple to get through to the process. And the idea that Graphegg decided to bring them all out within 1 publishing year was also a great vindication of our work. So. From our perspective, we very much celebrated the idea of these books in 3 languages.
It's just really exciting to, like, for all of our heart and our passion is all about Irish language publishing in what we did initially. But the idea of reaching further audiences and new audiences, and especially other Celtic minority language audiences, is just, it's kind of perfect, you know.
In terms of they're not speaking Welsh and then having your books published in Welsh. How does that process occur?
It's hard to say. I mean, we've been very lucky that Graphegg have taken this on themselves and really pushed this. And in a sense, Graphegg is such a great fit for us because they have got the same approach as myself and Mara have in terms of allowing the thing to grow and also the input they have.
And I think that, I kind of have a few different hats on and answering this insofar as I've had my books translated to different languages, like 10 languages now, most of which I would never expect to be able to figure out what they've done with it, if you know what I mean, when it's in Chinese or Korean or, you know, whatever language, you just accept and have respect for the role of the translator and that they will know what they need to do to make that work for that audience, because the problems that they're going to come across with your text won't be the things that you have the answer to. They understand their audience.
Yeah.
But I also am a translator, so I of other people's work, so I know exactly how that feels and how actually whether or not the author thinks or the illustrator thinks that you have, you know, got the exact same thing across is not maybe a fair judgment on the book, that actually, yeah, just the same point that the translator will know things that those people in that other language won't know. And that I read this beautiful thing once where someone said that translation is something that's been written twice. So it's like, it's not just that it's, you know, that you take this thing and you try somehow to squeeze it into a new space, which is sometimes what it feels like when you begin a translation. But actually, by the time you've finished, you've taken the concepts and the words and the feelings that are evoked by something, and you've maybe found a different expression of that that has the same feeling. You have to decide sometimes which is more important here, the meaning of this word, the feeling it evokes, or the associations with it. And you've got to trust that the translator knows what they're doing in that, and that they'll understand their own language and their own context, because there'll be things that just don't translate, you know. And even it's like it's even an interesting thing between the Irish and the English. I was very lucky in being able to do that, obviously, myself. And they're not the same. You know, the Irish and the English are not exact translations, because I allowed myself as the author of both of those things to say it a little bit differently, because, you know, it's the easiest translation job ever for me is when it's my own words, because I don't feel like I have to constantly go with the, you know, am I being true to the author's intentions? I am the author, so it's okay. But yeah, long-winded answer. But yeah, you've got to trust people's own skill bases. I think it's really, really important, and their own cultural knowledge.
And I have to say, I mean, going visually with the books, that when we first started bringing the Rita books out as a series, they had a very definite visual iconography in terms of the design of the covers and design of the interiors. And when Graphegg took them on, they standardized across the 6 books, which I thought was a great idea, because we had been experimenting with each book and said each one is a slightly individual piece. And when Graphegg took them on, they've standardized the font, they've standardized the layout, the covers, and the size also. All our Rita books were slightly different size. We're finding our way and experimenting with them and brought a new product out each year almost. But when Peter and the team over there took the 6 titles on, it was really refreshing to see what they did with them. And we very much respected that. So in the way of the translation or the way of the design of the books, we are very much respectful of good decisions. And we felt that Graphegg made very good decisions with the design of the books and the layouts. And I would expect that would translate also into the translations as well. Another aspect of Rita we haven't touched upon is when she gets to that stress point and the big ah in all of the books. And it doesn't always happen for the same reason or at the same point in the book. And that's one of the things we do get off on a wee bit.
It's actually quite interesting as well, Andy, because that has evolved over the years, because it was always ah when in Irish. But obviously, when I send you the text, I'll send you it in English.
Yeah.
And I remember this, that the initial ones had her saying no rather than ah. And it was actually something that happened when we were doing events, and the children always responded with this big scream. And we always had like the kind of the moment in the story where the whole room full of children go ah. And we realized, God, that's universal. We shouldn't be messing with that. We shouldn't be changing that when it goes to a different language, because that is actually one of the moments in every single Rita story. It's like a little building block, isn't it? It's essential. There's always the moment where she goes, ah, and that should be the same across different languages. I did have a moment where I did check that in Welsh she says, ah, and that somebody hadn't thought to translate it to something else, because I think it's just, it's such a from the gut kind of response that it's good to keep it. there we have it. Yep.
That's it. There, yeah. Yep.
And another one. I love that one with the Christmas tree, all the the bare Christmas tree. It's just a guttural expression. Yeah. It's just a scream, basically, but I kind of make it stop.
It's a universal language.
Yeah. Well, who knows? We might find out in some other language it has a completely different meaning that will change it.
Andrew, I remember you mentioned a reference in the book about Amelia Earhart's plane.
Yeah.
Now it's got me wondering, are there more references in these books that I should be looking for?
To something real in this world, that was a one-off thing because of the plane. I just thought the whole idea of adventure and, you know, this very strong female character, I think Amelia Earhart very much epitomized that. And I thought, Rita, you know, is that same sort of character? So that's the reason why that's there. Sometimes these things just happen because it's a natural progression. And the my idea of what to convey in that illustration. So sometimes they do just come up, but I'll not go out of my way to consciously try and do it with every book.
There are things, though, that are so incredible, like not necessarily references to the real world. Although what I've noticed is that thing we talked about earlier in this conversation about when people read and reread and reread a book, that you need enough detail in there that it'll take them a long time to discover. There are things that Andy, you have put in that I don't notice for ages, and very often it's a child who points them out to me and I'm like, whoa, how did I not see that before? So there are things that are like maybe easier to find, like there'll be pictures on walls in rooms that will be from other stories, or there'll be a toy robot lying on the floor in the ninja book, or there are kind of like references within the series in it. But like, for example, in that ninja book, I can believe that thing. Actually, it was you showed me about the eyes where the ninja.
Yeah.
And the ninja's actually looking through the eyes of the picture.
That's right. Yeah.
It's like, I don't even think anybody in the whole world will ever notice that. But once you showed it, I was like, that is just so amazing. The idea that there's all these kind of, I don't know if you'd call them Easter eggs, but there's all these like little tiny things that, you know, that if you search hard enough, there's more and more to find.
Yeah. And that's what I love about illustrating, because it's like those little freedoms that you have to do that no one knows about. See, I remember as a child a movie where the guy was behind the picture and the eyes were, and you had this guy watching everything in the room, you know, and that stuck with me. And then I thought, yeah, but this guy's also got a big nose. So that picture has got the two eyes cut out and the one for the nose, and the nose is sticking through as well. And I just thought that was hilarious. Just that
I
just
so tickled my fancy. That's so funny. And then the other thing that I love is in the robot book, there's a page in it where Rita has been making this marble run. And this was something that I actually sent you a photograph of my kids making a marble run out of toilet rolls and like sellotape or masking tape or whatever it was. And because I was kind of like this is what I mean. And I sent you a photo of my kids like on stools and whatever, sticking these toilet rolls to the wall to put marbles running down it. And then when you put it in the illustration, it's even got my living room floor in it. I just was like, wow, we're immortalized forever. And nobody right. else will ever know this, but I know that living room floor. I love those things.
Yeah.
I just saw the ninja one that you described. I would have never seen that.
No.
That's awesome. That's brilliant. I think we've got a good little glimpse into what's coming up next for Rita. But what I want to know is, what is your favourite Rita story? If you even have a favourite.
Yeah, it's really hard to answer. I think probably The Dragon, just because of what it's about, I think, that I really have got so much out of it since with children in the classroom, where we read the story and then talk about how she's feeling at different points and what's going on for her. And dealing with this question of how emotion transfers into the physical, what's happening in your body when you feel certain things. And so we have this kind of feelings charades game that the kids do. And so they get a feeling and then they have to act it out and their friends have to guess which feeling. And then we talk about, we all have to do it. You know, we have to show how our body, what happens in your body when you're afraid, or if you're excited, or if you're angry, and we act it all out. And it's great, because I think that kind of being able to name a feeling, recognize a feeling and name a feeling, was the first essential step in being able to deal with some of these things. And I find that it's when I'm doing this in the classroom, just I'm amazed at how, you know, kids are just so open sometimes, if you find the right little key in, and how they can tell you about the times when they felt this or they felt that, and what makes them feel like that, and what do they do? Because I suppose that's the whole point of that book, is then what does she do? What steps does she take? And really, you can read the book as a story, but you can also read that book as a step-by-step guide. You know, she goes somewhere on her own. She removes herself from the situation that's making her crazy. And then she comforts herself. You know, in the book, it's with a fire, but we talk about you can use a blanket or a teddy or your dog or whatever, finding some way of being kind to yourself. And she talks to someone and she breathes. And so we've all these different kind of things in the story that when you sort of pull them all out and work with them with children, it's just really exciting. So we do learn different breathing exercises. I've got an awful lot out of it, just I suppose, because of that work around it. So it'll have a really special place for me, I think, always. I just adore the illustrations of it as well. That forest scene with the sunset and the snow and the dragon is just, oh, I love it. So, yeah, that's mine. What about you, Andy?
I'm just thinking there. I'm coming from a different angle altogether, because for me, it starts when you give me the new story, Maura, and I get the text. And then you've always got like notes below suggesting what you think the scene would be. And then I go away and digest all of that. But for me, what it is, there's a process for me. Because we do everything ourselves in terms of the illustration, the writing, the design, and initially the publishing of it, I'm in control of the whole process, the product. Then, of course, the editing with other people that we know. So when you give me that story initially, the first thing I think of is, what's this new character going to look like? So it's like the key to the lock. The lock is opened when you get that, yeah, that character, and you've nailed it, and you know, yeah, you've nailed it. So I loved the genie, for instance, when I knew I'd nailed the genie, and I showed you the initial sketch of it, and then the process of doing the genie in the story. And then knowing that you're also experimenting with the media. So when Rita first started, it was all pen and ink and gouache, and then it moved on to pen and ink with colored paper. And then by the time we got to Rita Wants a Ninja, it went onto the iPad and Procreate. And that was all very experimental with Procreate. And where we are now is that all the Rita books are now done in Procreate. And it's like developing the skill. And all Procreate is another tool. And it's not making life any easier. It's just another tool through which to explore the Rita character. So I really enjoy that. And that's where I get a real kick. And then, of course, how the characters interplay with each other. So I get a lot of freedom to do that, and that's really what I love. So to cut a long story short, I love all the stories. I love each one as it comes in, and each new story is my favorite for as long as I do it. Until the next one comes in, I go, this is my favorite now, because I get a chance to more or less, as you said, you made a reference, Maura, to the sandbox. I'm just having a good time playing with illustration.
I think so much of my time has been spent bringing the book out on the road that it colours so much of how I feel about each book, and actually which pages of a book I learn that I grow to love most are the ones that get the big reactions. And you don't necessarily know that when you're writing it or illustrating it or selling it, or But when you're standing, you know, day after day in front of crowds of children, and they always laugh at the same bit, and they always gasp at the same bit, and they always scream at the same bit, and cover their eyes at the neck, you know, that that has really changed how I've seen what we've been doing. And so when I think of that, you know, the probably year I spent doing ninja training around schools with all the kids in the school hall with their headbands learning their ninjutsu doing their kind of, like, it's hard for me to separate that now from that book. That's what that book feels like to me. You know, the which things did I fill the boot with while I was touring the country.
It's just, for me, it's the excitement of starting a new project, a new adventure visually.
And it's an interesting thing because we're there in the middle of this, working on the new ones, and all of what that involves in that process. We're also then here talking about the older ones for us, which are now new ones in English and in Welsh. And then we're working on the TV series as well, which also involves revisiting the earlier ones in a completely new way. So it's just really interesting how it's like a cycle that just, you know, you're always at different places and in different parts of this kind of these spinning wheels.
The TV thing for me is very interesting, Maura, the way we've came around to this and how we're going to approach it. Because initially we thought, yeah, we're going to hand this over to an animation company and they're going to do retail their way and it's going to just be their thing. And I think the more we discussed it, and we looked at how much sweet time and effort and thought that we've invested in this project, that we realized, no, we've got our own ideas of how we want this to look. So the process now stands as that it's in the storyboarding phase. And I'm sitting storyboarding this at the moment and then passing it through to Maura. And then Maura's getting back to me with feedback on that. So that we know when we do go to the animation company, we're going to be very, very strong in our information of how we want this done. So it's not going to be handed over for a third party to have carte blanche of how they interpret
it. It's important to keep that to keep that creative control, I think, because as you say, the initial excitement of there's going to be a series, we've got broadcasters involved, you know, on board, and the funding's there, and the whole project is rolling, and then you go, oh, wait a minute, how does this thing translate to this new thing? And who gets to decide which things change in which ways? And so I think that'll just be really important for us, learning those ropes, that we're confident that we're doing the right thing by it. Yeah. But it's very, very exciting.
That's incredibly exciting that you started writing these and illustrating these books. And now it's kind of grown into different mediums, different languages. I mean, it's super exciting. And obviously you've put so much passion and time into this that you want to keep that creative control, and you want it to be how you imagined it. And all the stuff you're doing is amazing. And I do really hope you get to come to Wales to teach some Welsh kids some ninja skills.
Definitely.
Cool.
I might have to brush up on my my own ninja skills after a long period of the pandemic.
I'll have to attend so I can learn something. Final question though, Andrew, is should I have been calling you Mr. Ando, or do you prefer Andrew?
I prefer at this stage Mr. Ando. And I love Mr. Ando. And Mr. Ando came about because when I was a child, whenever I had done anything wrong, my mother would have said, Mr. Andrew, get down the stairs. And then you knew if you're called Mr. Andrew, that was it. You were in big, big trouble for something you weren't aware of. It could have been, you know, who put the bacon in the bin? Because I just didn't like bacon as a child. And then my friends in school called me Ando. So that was my nickname in school. So I thought, you know what? Mr. Ando's got a ring about it. And the children seem to have taken on that whole idea of me being called Mr. Ando now. So
they're actually intrigued by it, Andy, because it's like, who's Mr. Ando? Do you know him? And I'm like, yes, I know him.
The children seem to have actually taken to it in a big way, which I'm really delighted about. And when everyone mentions that name, they just start laughing. Yep. Now, when people laughed at me, I took it offensively. But now I just think it's a great vehicle for discussing any books or illustrated stuff I've done. It seems to be a key that's opened a door for children to approach me in a better way.
I think it's a great name for an illustrator.
Yeah.
I feel like I should have just called you that all the time, but I thought, you know, I'll use your real name. But Miss Oando sounds so cool. Thought I'd have to bring it up at some stage.
Well, thanks for doing that, Kieran. I appreciate it. I really like it myself. I might change my birth certificate.
Change your name officially by deed poll.
Yeah.
But yeah, thank you so much for coming on this podcast. We have unfortunately reached the end, and we've even gone a bit over, which is great. I've heard so many amazing stories from both of you, and I can't wait to see what comes next for Rita and the Rita series. I hope you come to Wales. Thank you, Myra and Mr. Ando, for coming on the podcast, and I hope you enjoyed listening.
Thank you, Kieran.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, and a big thank you to the Graphic team as well for helping us on this journey.
I mean, complimenting them on their own podcast, I love that. Yeah. Golden star there. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Kieran.
Thank you very much to Myra Zepf and Mr. Ando, also called Andrew Whitson, for coming on the podcast today to talk about the Rita series that they collaborated on. Absolutely great to talk to. Copies of the books can be found at any good local bookshops or online at graphic.com. This has been Meet the Author podcast, brought to you by Graphic Publishing, produced and presented by me, Kieran Minetta-Jones. Other episodes of Meet the Author can be found on graphic.com or anywhere where you're listening to this podcast. If you could leave us a review, that would be great, so it allows more people to listen to the stories from the people behind the books.